In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Yes, let's indeed. Time to talk movies. Pass the Popcorn. Alan Adams of The Main Edge joins us this afternoon. Hello there, Alan.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you, but I'm anxious to know, who is the winner? Who is the holder of the belt in your Oscar prediction contest?
You know, it's never who you expect. This year we do have a new champion. Adam Cousins.
Ooh.
Came out on top. He just like over the course of the night, he only missed on I think four total awards out of the whole mess. And when you consider how many surprises there were mixed in, I think that was a darn good performance.
I would say so. Well, let's talk about the awards themselves first, and the winners. No disagreement, I'm sure, with Best Picture.
Yep. No, I was I've been a pretty strong proponent of Nomadland ever since I saw it. I just think it's a beautiful film, and I think it certainly deserved the pick for Best Picture. And I thought it was a well-deserved directorial win for Chloe Zhao, which, leaving aside the historical aspect of it, which, don't get me wrong, is extremely important, the idea of an Asian American woman being nominated for that award, let alone winning it, is a big deal. But, just tremendous, tremendous work on that film. And so, yeah, winning those two was certainly what I saw coming, and I was glad to be proven right.
And Frances McDormand, having finally gotten around to seeing the film on Saturday, we sort of take for granted how brilliant she is, but again, another unforgettable performance.
You know, and it's so funny. It's one of those few places where I got into my head a little bit, and I allowed myself to be swayed by the sort of quote unquote conventional wisdom, and that was that. There seemed to be a very strong late push for Carey Mulligan for her performance in Promising Young Woman, but I was back and forth, and I even said it in the piece where I went with Mulligan, but I said that I would probably prefer McDormand or even Viola Davis instead. And so to see Frances McDormand win and to be able to you get a lot of talk about the Meryl Streeps of the world and all that. That's three Oscars for Frances McDormand. That is a very small club that she has entered into with that win. And, just a remarkable performance from her, and just a reminder that, she's just got just a tremendous, tremendous talent. And again, we're lucky to have her.
And the big surprise came at the end of the night with the Oscar for Best Actor going to Anthony Hopkins. I think everybody in the world just assumed that Chadwick Boseman would get it. Now, I didn't see The Father, but those I've talked to said it was pretty great, and his performance was certainly deserving.
Well, I mean, I think that was, you heard a fair number of sort of the pundits offer up, variations on the some of Hopkins's best work, but it seems unlikely that he'll be able to overcome both the quality of performance and circumstances surrounding the performance put forward by Chadwick Boseman. And I think the sense I've been getting is that there were a lot of voters out there who were like, well, Chadwick Boseman's going to win, so I can throw a vote to Anthony Hopkins. Because, again, it's like you said, and I also have yet to see The Father, but literally everything I've heard is that it is just a phenomenal performance from Anthony Hopkins. And, I don't know if you had a chance to see his sort of recorded thank you that was put out this morning.
I did, yeah.
He seemed kind of baffled by it, too. I think he was just like the rest of us. I think he sort of expected that that Chadwick Boseman was going to win the award, and so much so that he was in bed when it was announced. And granted, it was like 4 a.m. in Wales or whatever, but still. It just goes to show you that you never know. it's interesting too to think about. The powers that be organizing the broadcast clearly thought that Chadwick Boseman was going to win.
Do you think that was my theory? Is that was the reason why they shuffled around the order?
Yeah, and it's like, and I knew it became clear early on that they were trying to mix things up a little bit, and that's fine. Now's the time to do it when you're sort of forced by circumstance into things being a little experimental. But the idea of it seemed. Even before you sort of, viewed it as this sort of, going out on this celebratory note of someone gone too soon, it still felt weird to not end with Best Picture, because that's the big one. Mm. That's the one that's for however many decades has been sort of the culmination of not just this evening, but of the cinematic year as a whole. And so to shift that around, it didn't sit right. And then when you have the final award of the night going to someone who's not present and being accepted by someone who didn't really seem all that interested in being there, you just wind up with this very anticlimactic ending to a show that was already sort of struggling in some ways.
As someone pointed out on Twitter too, one of the great things about doing Best Picture last is that the movie always shows up for the award.
Right. And I guess that's the thing. And, some would argue, okay, well, better to have a speech at the end, from someone that you know, as opposed to producers talking about the movie. And it's like, okay, that's great in theory, but you forgot to take into account the fact that maybe someone's going to win who's not there. And then you just get a confused Joaquin Phoenix saying, "We accept on his behalf. Peace out." And then the credits roll. I enjoyed the show. I always do. And it was great to see the efforts being made to at least approach something resembling that sort of normalcy. I think there are some benefits to a scaled down version of the ceremony, and this idea of having sort of satellite location. I didn't hate that. I thought that was kind of nice.
And I like the intimate feel, particularly early on. And I really like the fact, and it didn't work with everybody, but I like the fact that they weren't playing people off during their acceptance speeches.
Well, it's just, the reality is the deal with that, especially when you're doing a live broadcast, is the earlier you go in the ceremony, the more time you're going to have for your speech. And that because once the time starts getting backed up a little bit, the next thing you know, you're getting an Oscar, a culmination of your life's work. You're up there and the band's playing by the time you get to the microphone, and it's just, and I loved the idea of, and I'm in full agreement. I loved the idea of people just let these people tell me about how they feel. It's such a huge deal in the lives of these people. That genuine emotion, that beats the heck out of, whatever big production number or, a stale, themed 10-minute, stand-up bits or whatever. Frankly, the only real screeching halt moment I had for the ceremony was the very flop sweaty Lorel Howery wandering through the audience trying to get people to acknowledge, to play music trivia. It was weird, it was forced, and it just did not feel of a piece with everything else that we had seen up until that point. And so so it's again an interesting experiment. I have no doubt that assuming things are back to something resembling normal, it's going to be we're going to fill the theater with tuxedos, and we're going to go back to doing it the way we've done it in the past. That would be my guess.
My other bone to pick. Well, there were a couple. I would like to have seen more clips of films, but also it really bothered me. And I know there were a lot of people to get to in this COVID year, but the fact that they literally flew through the in memoriam segment, and if you blinked, you missed somebody.
It felt rushed in a way that honestly, I don't believe that the Academy was an intentional slight on
no,
the
no,
part of
I
the
don't
Academy
either.
Or any of the, but I mean, you gotta build in that time. Like, you just have to. Like, I mean, it's one of those, in some ways, it's the last, and in some cases only, chance for, people who love movies, and those are the people who are watching the Oscars, are people who love movies. It's the last chance to say goodbye to some of these people, like, and people who hadn't necessarily been in the spotlight as much in recent years, or what have you, or work behind the scenes, or, you know, it's just one last chance to just to recognize the contributions that so many people have made to making something like the Oscars matter, you know, because movies matter, and those are the people who make it so, and to remove that last chance to pay our last respect. Yeah, I agree. Like, it's, it felt like they had a set amount of time, and they just had to just blur through it in order to, hit the post or whatever. It was just, I don't know. I agree with you. It was, it didn't feel right.
We're talking with Alan Adams here on Downtown. All right, a couple of new movies you had a chance to see, Stowaway and Mortal Kombat. Which one do you want to tell us about first?
Let's talk about Mortal Kombat for a second. I'm someone, I am of the perfect age, of someone who has a very strong affection for the Mortal Kombat video game franchise. Like, I was, I was in my early teens when that game first hit arcades, and I spent a fair amount of money, lawn mowing money and whatnot, just learning which buttons to push when, and which direction to push the joystick to make these various characters, kill one another in horrifying and gruesome ways. And so, it's interesting to think about the idea that, because the first Mortal Kombat movie came out in, 1995. Like, this is a very old piece of IP. And to think that it's taken this long for them to revisit it, particularly in an era when it seems like the lion's share of what we get is warmed over in nostalgia trips and IP driven blockbusters. And this is, two for the price of one with this. So it was interesting to see that it took so long. It's a Warner Brothers joint. So it's in theaters now, but also available for streaming on HBO Max. Like I said, based on the video game series, it's directed by a gentleman by the name of Simon McCoy, who, near as I can tell, has never directed a movie before, so that was an interesting choice. But yeah, it's an effort to basically breathe new cinematic life into characters that have been very popular for almost 30 years now. And it sort of succeeds, but not really, but kind of. It's complicated. it's a good faith effort. I'll be upfront about that. And there's some narrative expansion, but it's awfully muddy and convoluted in ways that they really detract from the basic fundamental appeal of Mortal Kombat. When you're sort of trying to graft new characters and situations onto this already rich and extant foundation, you're left with a movie that doesn't really seem able to get out of its own way. Like, there's some decent martial arts action, and I was pleasantly surprised by just how over the top and viscerally gory it was, because that's a hallmark of the game. But the clunkiness of the sort of story development kind of basically caps your ceiling. There's a basic floor and a ceiling with a movie like this, and the story kind of undermines that ceiling to an extent where it was only ever going to be so good. I'll try to give you a plot synopsis, Rich, but let's be real, that's not what we're here for. But basically, we start in 17th century Japan. There's a legendary warrior named Hanzo Hisashi who gets ambushed by the Lin Kui clan, led by the powerful Bihan. Hanzo needs to be killed so that to destroy the Shirai Ryu clan. However, Hanzo's infant daughter survives the attack, and she's rescued and spirited away by the thunder god Raiden, as happens. Flash forward to the present, we are in the world, in Outworld, and this is where we get the basic gist of Mortal Kombat. So, quick primer for anyone who's unfamiliar, So there's a magical fighting competition dubbed Mortal Kombat that takes place between champions from our world, Earthrealm, and the sinister evildoers of Outworld. And if Outworld's champions defeat ours 10 times in a row, the dimensional veil is pierced and Outworld's forces can conquer us and blah, 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 blah. But as it turns out, Rich, we've lost the last 9. So this next one's pretty important. But there's a prophecy, one that declares that the blood of Hanzo Hayashi will be the downfall of the ruthless leader of Outworld, Shang Tsung. So he enlists Bi-Han, who's apparently immortal. I don't know exactly how that came about. He's now known as Sub-Zero because he has magic cold powers. And he has to go to Earth and kill all the champions before the tournament. That way he automatically wins, or something. It's not really clear. From there, we meet a gentleman by the name of Cole Young, former champion MMA fighter who has fallen from grace. But he does what he can to sort of take care of his family. He's also the bearer of this mark that apparently labels him as a champion of Earth, which means that Sub-Zero is going to come for him. He gets tracked down by a pair of former Special Forces operatives / Mortal Kombat conspiracy theorists named Jax and Sonya, brought into the fold, and they wind up going to Raiden's Thunder God Temple to train to harness their quote-unquote arcana, which is basically the magic power that comes from being a champion. While all the, you know, to learn in time to defeat the many evil forces massing against them. Look, I know that I said a lot of words there. There's not a lot that actually happens in this movie. There's not a lot of actual story. Like, there are a lot of nods to the sort of overarching Mortal Kombat mythos, but in terms of actual narrative, like, it ain't much. And again, I'll concede that I am not above getting excited when there's a direct reference to the video game in the movie. Like, I'm not going to spoil any of those, but they are very much present. And you will, if you are a fan, you will also be excited as well. Look, I enjoyed myself. I was predisposed to enjoy this movie. Like, I loved the game. I loved the original 1995 film. So I was gonna dig it, and I did. But Rich, I can in no uncertain terms tell you that this is a bad movie. It is not good. It is not a good movie. Like, if you're here for martial arts action, like, there's some skilled combatants here, but a lot of that skill kind of gets sacrificed on the altar of CGI. There's just a lot of digital noise, and that undermines what you're seeing. But if you are a fan of the sort of over-the-top, you know, blood and guts over an early Sam Raimi, then you're going to find plenty to like, because they really lean into the absurdity of the sort of the extreme nature of the game's fundamentals. So there's a real bloodbath that is, you know, frankly hilarious. Performances kind of blah. Like, most of the time they're left to sort of lean on the admittedly deep set of characteristics and qualities dictated by the long histories that we have with these characters. And again, that assumption of familiarity is understandable, though I would argue it's ill-advised, certainly in terms of, you know, barriers to entry for anyone who's not super familiar. And then there's this, you know, our lead character is an original character created specifically for the film, so we don't even get that sort of history. And so there's a flatness to it that really impacts everything that happens around it. Like, okay, this is a deeply flawed film, and it's one that doesn't quite capture the energy that made its source material so successful. But if you're a fan of the franchise, like, you'll probably find some stuff to like. Basically, it boils down to, you know, this is a movie that is bloody, dumb, and frankly, bloody dumb. And sometimes that's what you're looking for.
All right, now let's move on to Stowaway. What about that?
Now, this one, I wasn't sure about this one. I hadn't heard a lot about it. But it's part of the sort of ongoing Netflix push, their sort of determination that they're going to release at least one major film a week over the course of this entire year. And so this is a pretty high-end product. I can't speak for everyone, but I personally have always been sort of fascinated by stories that kind of spring from the dangers that come with distance. Particularly like long journeys, whether we're talking about in the wilderness or across the ocean or into the sky, like the perils of separation from those who could help us if an emergency should arise can really make for a compelling drama. And, you know, I feel like space stories have kind of supplanted a lot of those, you know, treks into the wild or over the waves. Like, there's just so many of these space stories, particularly ones that kind of want to hew relatively close to the realm of plausibility, like revolve around this idea that help will not and cannot come. So in space, you're basically on your own. And that's the gist of this new movie. It's directed by a guy named Joe Penna, who co-wrote the script with Ryan Morrison. It's an exploration of the sort of unforgiving nature of the unknown and sort of the emotional consequences that can come with being forced to make an impossible choice. And it's also a pretty solid space movie, like one where they've clearly taken great care to maintain a degree of verisimilitude. It's near future sci-fi, so there are some technological loops that, you know, you have to take into account. But for the most part, they clearly at least consulted with people who knew how all this stuff works. And so there's a logistical sort of reality to it that you don't always get with space movies. And so that's really fun. But the basic gist is this. We're just getting underway with a 2-year mission to Mars. There's already a Mars colony, so I don't know how far into the future we are, but we've got a 3-person mission. You've got the captain of the ship is Marina Barrett, played by Toni Collette. And she's joined by a plant biologist named David Kim, played by Daniel Day Kim, and a medical researcher named Zoe Levinson, played by Anna Kendrick. And this is the trio. They go into orbit. They tether their ship to part of the launch vehicle and create, you know, that set it spinning, and that's our sort of inertia-based artificial gravity. Again, I don't know the scientific logistics, whether or not that's realistic, but they gave me enough where I'm like, okay, I'll buy this. They're only a few hours into the trip, though, when they make this, they make a discovery. Basically, a passenger. They find this guy, Michael, played by Shamir Anderson, who is a launch support engineer with NASA, unconscious and bleeding, like, behind a service panel. The doctor, patches him up, and he eventually regains consciousness, but the ship's moving too fast for them to turn around, so like it or not, he's part of the mission now. But as it turns out, the accident that hurt Michael also damaged an important piece of equipment, specifically a device intended to scrub carbon dioxide from the air supply, which was vital to maintaining breathable air for the duration of the journey, and it can't be fixed. So it becomes very clear, as things stand, there's no way for 4 people to survive this mission over the duration. And as they keep reaching for solutions, it grows more and more frantic, and then, you know, the more unthinkable options start to rear their head. Like, if 4 people can't survive, what about 3? Or what have you. And so you have all these moral and ethical ramifications kind of swirling as these 4 people have to confront the harsh reality of the situation. Like, without a miracle, they're essentially doomed. But that the weight of that decision remains present. So it's like, is there an answer? And if there is it an answer whose impact they can bear? This was it's really taut. Like, this is a really tight narrative. You know, I mean, the action in the movie takes place over the course of just a few days, and that central conflict, and I'm not going to talk about the resolutions because, again, spoilers, but it basically boils down to the stowaway and what can be done. Like, it's this wonderful look at what it means to make life or death decisions on an individual level, making those choices when they directly impact you. Like how much can you sacrifice for the well-being of another, and how can you ask someone else to make that sacrifice instead of you? And again, I spoke about the sort of plausibility of the space travel stuff. And again, big leaps, and, you know, there's some stuff like, you know, the ship's always too big and things like that. But it feels possible in a way that sci-fi doesn't always concern itself with, and it has a lot of those of little touches that illustrate those efforts. But one of the great choices, just an absolutely masterful directorial choice, is the complete absence of any other voices. Like, there are communications with, Mission Control, and they have communications with, like, the media and their family members and whatnot. But whenever that's happening, we only hear their sides of the respective conversations. No matter who they're speaking to, we never hear the words being spoken to them. And it's this wonderfully elegant way that really reinforces the just absolute isolation in which these people are operating. It's a shorthand to remind us of how just on their own they actually are. It also means you've got a really small cast. Like, there's just four people, which made me think when I was watching it, I'm like, oh, this must be a pandemic movie. Like, just because in terms of the feasibility, the practical aspect of it, like a four-person cast, like that really seems like something. But, yeah, it actually wrapped, like, in the summer of 2019. Like, so, I mean, this was in the can before the pandemic even started. Speaking of that cast, it's really good. Like, it had a really good cast. I suppose you'd call Kendrick the star. I think she has the most screen time, but it really is very much an ensemble piece. You know, and between her and Daniel Day-Kim and Toni Collette, like, just incredible talent. And Shamira Anderson, who is was by far the most unfamiliar face of the bunch for me, was really he really held his own. Like, he's he really connected, and there's a real chemistry with this cast. And it's probably unsurprising that the movie is really at its best when any or all of them are sort of coming together to confront the sort of moral quagmire of the situation. Like, there's a very it all feels very genuine. In a way that you don't always expect from this sort of genre movie. Like, there's just the quality of performance is very high, and so it really elevates that central idea into something that really works. Again, there are a couple of small issues, like the pacing lags a little bit in the middle third of the movie, but for the most part, it works because it focuses on the complexities of the circumstances, like sort of allowing all the tumblers to kind of fall into place around that really troubling central conflict. And, you know, it's the idea that matters of life and death are never small, but by forcing the characters to sort of deal with them in sort of isolation, what Stowaway does is create this really tense and emotionally fraught sort of sci-fi thriller. It's a film that confronts you with the question of what is to be done when, to quote another phenomenal space movie, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one.
All right, we look forward to seeing it. That sounds better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it's like I was not expecting it. I was not expecting to enjoy the movie as much as I did, but it's really solid.
All right, we'll check that out. The word on a couple of brand spanking new movies: Mortal Kombat and Stowaway. Alan, we thank you as always. Wednesday, you're getting that second vaccination. Good luck with that.
Yeah, I'm getting jabbed, and I figured rather than risk being under the weather and trying to, you know, screw up your whole radio thing, I figured I'd give you a heads up.
We'll screw it up on our own without you. But listen, the good news is once they get that second chip, you get many more cable channels. All the streaming services come right to your head.
Oh, man, I'm crossing my fingers for Discovery Plus, baby.
There you go. Good luck with that, Al. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, buddy.